is up on the board on the right here. And it may look like I'm going to be doing a lot of singing in the next 2 hours, but fortunately for you, that's not the case. I'll start with just a few comments about singularities in general relativity, and then make a few remarks about singularities in another approach to quantum gravity, the loop quantum gravity approach. I'll give you a very quick course in string theory, emphasizing the topics and the aspects that we're going to need to talk about singularities. I'll then go through several examples of singularities that are resolved in string theory, but then give one example of a singularity which is not resolved. So I'm going to argue that string theory doesn't resolve all singularities and tell you that I think that's a very good thing. But then we'll come to probably the topic of most interest to this audience, the singularities in cosmology. And I'll tell you a bit about what is known there. And if there's time, at the end, I'll describe some recent work about singularities inside black holes in string theory. So that's basically the framework for the discussion. And so without further ado, let me start. The singularities in general relativity. So as you all know, in general relativity, we define singularities in terms of geodesic incompleteness. This is the inability of geodesics to be extended to arbitrarily large values of their affine parameter. And in the late 60s, there was a series of famous theorems, mostly by Hawking and Penrose, showing that large classes of solutions to Einstein's equations were singular. These are the famous singularity theorems. Now, recently, there's been a qualitative change in our understanding of singularities inside black holes in general relativity. So I wanted to mention this to you, since you may not be aware of it. So let me write down the Penrose diagram for the sort of standard black holes of general relativity. So we have a Schwarzschild black hole with a Penrose diagram that looks like this. I think most of you are probably familiar with this, but this is a diagram in which light rays are at 45 degrees. Infinity has been brought into a finite distance by conformal rescaling. This is the event horizon. And this is infinity. OK, we also have the Penrose diagram for a Kerr black hole, which looks quite different. So this is Kerr, and there's other regions here. Keeps going. The main difference is that in addition to the event horizon, which is the boundary of all events that can send signals out to infinity, there is another surface here called the inner horizon. And it's been known, well, since the early 70s, that the inner horizon is unstable. And it was long believed that generic perturbations would cause this instability to grow, and that you would have some sort of singularity which would be space-like, resembling the space-like singularity of Schwarzschild. So it was thought that the typical black hole would have singularities, would have a sort of causal structure globally looking more like Schwarzschild. But in fact, there has been increasing evidence over the past decade, and I would say that it's now been rigorously proven for the case of a charged black hole, Reisner-Nordström, and very good evidence even for the case of Kerr, that when you perturb this inner horizon, the singularity does not become space-like. In fact, it stays null, and so the perturbed space-time has a singularity like this. So the recent results are saying that the inner horizon is indeed unstable. It becomes singular, but the singularity is null. And furthermore, it's weak in the sense that the metric is actually continuous across this surface. It's only that the derivatives of the metric blow up. The tidal force instantaneously blows up, but the total integrated tidal force is finite. So the total tidal force integrated from somebody crossing the surface would actually be finite. So the instability is not as bad as we thought, and it's not causing the singularity to be space-like. Moreover, it was pointed out to me that just this summer by one of the people who've proven this, de Fermos, that a generic perturbation of Schwarzschild will, of course, add some angular momentum. It's a very rare perturbation that will keep the angular momentum exactly zero. And therefore, the Schwarzschild singularity is really unstable. You perturb this, you're going to add a little angular momentum to the black hole. The causal structure will look more like this. And so we should think of the singularity inside Schwarzschild, inside a typical black hole, as being one of these null singularities, not being a space-like one. Yes? Yes. The curvature is certainly diverging. You can see that in, say, components of the curvature in parallelly propagated frames. Now you're asking if there's a scalar curvature invariant which blows up. In many cases of null singularities, you don't have scalar invariants because the curvature is, in a sense, null, and so when you square it, it always vanishes. I don't recall offhand. It might be that there are some sort of derivatives of the curvature stuff which still blow up in this case. Yeah? Yeah, that was sort of deliberate. I think it is not known for sure, but it is believed that it does not continue null up to this point, but that it's expected to sort of flop over and become space-like eventually. Okay. So the idea is that the singularity is null, but it eventually, you know, might become space-like over there. Yeah, Rob? Well, actually, all that you need is continuity on one side. So the claim is that you can sort of look at how the metric behaves as you approach the surface, and the metric has a continuous limit to the null surface. I mean, you're right. To say something about really being continuous on the other side, you have to say something about the boundary conditions at the singularity. But just approaching it from the side where it is all determined, the metric has a continuous extension, and it's only the derivatives which blow up. It has a finite what? Length? Limit, yes. Yes, it has finite limits.
This singularity is a very... Okay, in the Schwarzschild case, it is a very drastic singularity. I can see, scalar curvature invariants blowing up. You think that by adding some small perturbation that's actually going to produce a null singularity where that's probably not happening? That just seems a little bit far-fetched, or my intuition would say.
Well, remember what happens near this point, of course, you know, the region in here may not change much because that might map over to a region more like this. But what happens near here, of course, is very sensitive to what happens, you know, for all time in the universe. And so if you throw in something, cause it to become a rotating black hole, I could imagine that the structure of the singularity in this region changes. So okay. Just to sort of, so I would claim the idea is that the Schwarzschild singularity is unstable. So sort of J not equal to zero perturbation. Okay, well that's a bit of a surprise, yeah.
I'm a little confused how the singularity can be exactly null and then become space-like at some point. It doesn't sound very analytic.
Well, singularities don't have to be analytic.
Yeah, but if you obtain this from a small perturbation of Schwarzschild or something, or if you start from Kerr, I don't know. I mean, is there there's really a discontinuity in the
Well, I can tell you what's happening, right? Since the metric is continuous, there's actually a well-defined metric on this null surface. And the sort of two spheres on the null surface have a finite area. Now, as you go up the null surface here, the area of those two spheres shrinks. And so the idea is that eventually you're going to reach a point where that area goes to zero. And when that happens, the singularity somehow becomes stronger and is believed to be space-like and not have this feature that the tidal forces are finite and things like that. OK, so let me move on to make one more comment about singularities in general relativity. And that's just to remind you about the standard picture of cosmological singularities. Here we have the picture first presented by Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz, the so-called BKL behavior or BKL chaos. And the idea is that when you approach a space-like singularity in general relativity, different spatial points will actually decouple. Sort of space so they start evolving independently. And what they evolve, how they evolve, is as sort of anisotropic universes, so-called Kasner universes, where different spatial directions are expanding or contracting at different rates. And along a given point, you'll find that the universe goes through different Kasner epochs, which means that you'll have periods of time where the universe is expanding in some direction and contracting in others. And then there'll be this so-called bounce where the sort of exponents will all get changed in some directions that were expanding, now contract, and vice versa. And it's been argued that that will, according to general relativity, actually happen an infinite number of times as you approach a singularity. So it happens in sort of a log time in terms of the distance to the singularity. And you'll go through these many, many different epochs where the you have an anisotropic sort of so-called Kasner expansion or contraction sort of many, many times. Obviously many. So these exponents get shuffled as you go through each of these bounces. OK, so that's just a few comments about singularities in general relativity. Now let me move on to the second topic here, singularities in loop quantum gravity. Yeah. In the BKL analysis? Let's see, I think BKL originally looked at just the vacuum Einstein equations. This was not of the same character of the singularity theorems, right? Singularity theorems are very general, saying if matter satisfies some inequalities, you get singularities. BKL, I think, is more of a detailed property of the Einstein equation. In fact, it's known that if you couple gravity to just a scalar field, an ordinary massless scalar field, which would satisfy reasonable energy conditions, you don't get BKL behavior. So it's not something, it really is a property of the detailed Einstein equations, not just an energy condition. Okay. Well, I'm certainly not an expert in loop quantum gravity, but there have been some interesting results obtained in this area, which I thought I should mention. So first, what is loop quantum gravity? It's basically an attempt to straightforwardly quantize general relativity using canonical quantization. So starting with the initial value formulation, you would normally take as sort of your initial data some three metric ij and say its time derivative or extrinsic curvature. And then you have constraints, and then you can evolve and get solutions to general relativity. If you want to quantize general relativity canonically, the sort of straightforward thing to do would be to consider wave functions of this three metric, and then impose the constraints as operator value constraints on the wave function. And so there's a constraint called the Hamiltonian constraint, or the scalar constraint of the initial value problem. And viewed as an operator, this constraint has to annihilate the wave function. That's your condition for physical states. And this is what's called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Now, this was an approach to quantum gravity which was discussed a lot by Wheeler and DeWitt and others back in the 60s, and didn't go too far. It just was hard to make sense of the operator. It was resurrected in the 1980s by Abhayashtakar and colleagues. And their main point was that it's much better not to use these variables, but to use instead to use a connection, basically the connection associated with the metric, and the associated variable is now a triad. So this is sort of like a connection, actually you can think of it as an SU2 connection, or connection associated with rotations on the space-like surface. And this is a triad of, which has the same information as the spatial metric. And this is has the same information essentially as the extrinsic curvature. But it's the same idea. You now take wave functions of the connection and have some operator like the Hamiltonian constraint annihilating wave functions of the connection. Okay, by using analogies to ordinary gauge theories, people were able to make more sense of this, although I have to say that it appears that there's still not a unique, universally agreed upon definition of what this operator is. So I think there's still some ambiguity in how people define it, but they've certainly got better control over it than when it was viewed as some operator acting on functions of the metric. Well, the recent progress in singularities has come mostly from work of a young guy named Bojewald. And what Bojewald did was to sort of look at a mini superspace model. So rather than do the usual mini superspace, which was to first basically truncate everything down to a couple of degrees of freedom, and then quantize those few degrees of freedom, which was the sort of thing that people had been doing for decades. Bojewald said, let's start with this framework of loop quantum gravity that has already been set up, and see what happens if we quantize it and then impose the symmetries on this sort of full quantum theory. So he sort of looks at a mini superspace say consisting of just homogeneous isotropic metrics with a scalar field. So there's basically only 2 degrees of freedom, a scale factor A, and a scalar field phi. And what was found Of course, they don't work with A. They work with some corresponding connection variable and triad variable, but it's effectively this sort of mini superspace. And what they find is that if you use a variable like the scale factor as time, they find bounces. So they find, roughly speaking, a scale factor. I mean, the value of the scalar field as a function of the scale factor is perfectly fine, and there's some continuation past what would be the Big Bang. So they find a bounce with no initial singularity. Now, if you ask why is this happening, I think the key reason is that there is this operator which is measuring the volume. So you have an operator which is going like A cubed. And in this framework, they can construct an inverse to this operator and show that it's bounded. In other words, in this approach, 1 over A cubed is bounded. So that is, I think, the origin of all of these results which come out. In some sense, when in this quantization, the volume is never allowed to go to zero. Well, because the volume is not going to zero, you get deviations from ordinary Einstein gravity on small scales. And there have been some people who've been looking at whether you can use those deviations to get inflation or something like that. I should probably also mention that this has been extended to black holes. And there is some talk that there's no singularity inside a black hole for basically the same reason. The geometry inside a black hole, as you know, is very much like an anisotropic cosmology. And this idea, which was originally discussed for the homogeneous isotropic case, has been extended to anisotropic universes. And so people think that it should remove the singularity inside black holes as well. So, I mean, what's that? That's the point, yeah. I mean, A is not quite the right variable because they have a variable which is more like the triad, which makes more sense if it goes through zero. In some sense, it's changing direction. So this is should be more like a sort of a E or something. But anyway, it is like it is something like the metric is going through zero, and the scalar field is remaining fine. And so this is where the singularity should occur, and they find no singularity. That's exactly the, yeah, Robert. Could you wait for the microphone? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
So the question is whether the inverse volume operator is also bounded, can also be made into a bounded operator in the full theory. And this is not the case.
Ah.
But there's another result which tests the inverse volume operator on coherent states, which are peaked at zero volume. And there, at least, you get bounded values for these expectation values. So it's quite a not clear issue whether these results can be repeated in the full theory or not.
OK, thank you. OK. Well, let me move on then to string theory. And the first thing we learn in string theory is that space has more than four, or space-time has more than four dimensions. People talk about 10 or 11 space-time dimensions. So at the very first step, the easiest thing to do is just to think about general relativity in higher dimensions. And let me make a couple comments about that. Okay, so this is basically string theory. And well, it's recently become clear that there are qualitatively different properties of black holes in higher dimensions. In four dimensions, black holes satisfy a number of sort of, or have a number of special properties. It's been known that, well, say the horizon is always spherical. There are the uniqueness theorems, which say that vacuum black holes are always characterized by their mass and angular momentum. And, of course, black holes are stable. And what's become clear in the past couple years is that all of these properties fail in higher dimensions. So okay, so these are really special properties of four dimensions and not special properties of black holes. So let me just say a word about that. The reason they all fail is because of something called, well, starting with something called the black string. So even in five dimensions, you can take a product of four-dimensional Schwarzschild cross a line that gives you an object which has an event horizon, which is a sphere S2 cross R. So it looks like a one-dimensional extended object surrounded by an event horizon. So this is sometimes called the black string. And it was shown by Gregory and Laflamme that this black string is unstable to long wavelength perturbations. So already we have an object, perfectly good static solution with a horizon which is unstable. And I should say the outcome of this instability, what this object settles down to, is still not understood. It's still being debated. But more importantly, you can take this black string, wrap it up into a circle, and spin it, and obtain another solution, which is called the black ring. So this is an object which sort of looks like a torus. Its horizon is now an S2 cross S1. It's a nice compact horizon, finite area and everything, sitting inside an asymptotically flat five-dimensional space-time, stationary. It has angular momentum and mass. But its horizon is clearly not a three-sphere. It's not topologically the same as what you would get from a five-dimensional Schwarzschild metric. So the solutions are not stable, not necessarily, and they're not always spherical. And in fact, they're not always characterized by their mass and their angular momentum, because it was shown by the people who discovered this, Amperon and Rial, a couple years ago, that for some values of the mass and angular momentum, there are actually three different types of solutions. There are two different solutions which look like this black ring with sort of different thickness and different horizon radius, but somehow managing to have the same mass and angular momentum. And there's also a spherical black hole. which was discovered almost 20 years ago by Myers and Perry. So there are S3 rotating black holes, the direct generalization of the Kerr metric, and this S2 cross S1 black ring. So one has to be careful that properties of black holes that we're used to in 4 dimensions don't necessarily hold in higher dimensions. But what about, yeah, question?
I don't know if you're going to come to this later, but so if you are, you can come to it later. But what's special about 4 dimensions? Why are 4-dimensional black holes different from higher dimensional black holes?
Things are just much more restrictive in 4 dimensions. You know, gravity has more freedom on it. I'm not sure if I can say anything more. I mean, there are black holes in 3 dimensions if you have this sort of negative cosmological constant, the so-called BTZ. And as far as we know, they satisfy these conditions as well.
But why is 4 sort of the limit? Why is there a qualitative? I mean, is there a qualitative change from going to 5 to 6, for example?
I mean, one difference from here, well, there could be more. Certainly when you go from 5 to 6, we expect even more types of black holes. In other words, there could be things maybe with an S2 cross S2 horizon. It's not known, but it's likely, I would say, that there's many more topologies for black holes in higher dimensions. I think in four dimensions, the horizon's a two-dimensional surface, and you get constraints like, you know, positive scalar curvature, which, you know, just very restrictive on a 2-manifold, but much less restrictive when you have higher dimensions. I think that's all I can say.
Just asking the same question again, I guess. Is there some, so, for example, in the proof of the no-hair theorem, is there some particular step that goes through in 4 dimensions but fails in higher dimensions?
Oh, yeah. Proof of the no-hair theorem. Well, obviously, yes. We have counterexamples. But if you wanted me to tell you what the precise step is, I mean, that again, was proven by using sort of the detailed form of Einstein's equations. You can basically use the symmetry. We're assuming the spacetimes here are stationary and axisymmetric. Those are the sort of, well, you assume it's stationary and you can prove it's axisymmetric. So that means that you're basically dealing with a 2-dimensional problem. And again, in 2 dimensions, things are much more restrictive. And once you have a problem in 3 dimensions, 4 dimensions, there's more solutions.
Are there also black strings in 4D if you have negative cosmological constant?
Yes. And if you have negative cosmological constant, you can do lots of things. So there are analogs of black strings in 4 dimensions.
And they also have the Gregory-Laflamme instability?
They have less. Yes, there are some which are certainly unstable. There may be some which are stable. And it really depends on sort of how thick they are. With negative cosmological constant, there's in some sense an upper limit on how long a wavelength perturbation you can have, because the negative cosmological constant acts like a confining box, and basically you don't have arbitrarily long wavelength perturbations like you do in an asymptotically flat spacetime. So if the instability required a perturbation whose wavelength was, say, bigger than a scale set by the negative cosmological constant, then that black string would probably be stable. Okay. So let me also comment on this BKL behavior in higher dimensions, because once again, we discover that it's not always true. It's not a property of vacuum Einstein equations in all dimensions. But interestingly enough, it's not restricted just to 4 dimensions. So if you ask, sort of, is Okay, do you have this sort of BKL behavior near space-like singularities? The answer is only if you're doing vacuum general relativity. It was true in 4 dimensions, and it's true in 5 dimensions, and it's true up to 10 dimensions, but not higher. So for vacuum, the answer is yes, for only for d less than or equal to 10. Well, that's a very interesting number. If you're in 11 or higher dimensions, vacuum general relativity doesn't have this BKL behavior. Of course, in string theory, we have there's something called M theory, which is an 11-dimensional theory, but it's not a vacuum theory. There's a matter field coming from supergravity, well, you know, coming from string theory, or M theory, I should say. And it turns out that if you include that matter field, that particular matter field predicted by supergravity, then you have BKL behavior even in 11 dimensions. So for supergravity, the answer is again yes. So in all of the cases where we have, and this was shown, well, the vacuum case was shown by Hanno, and then the sort of general case was shown by Thibaut Amour, Hanno. So in all the cases where we have supergravity, in all the cases we have low energy limits from string theory, we in fact have this BKL behavior. But if you were to go to higher dimensions, or just add extra matter fields that were not related to supersymmetry, in general, you can destroy this BKL behavior. OK, saw some questions. Yeah.
How restrictive is this? I mean, can you turn this argument around? If you want to have BKL behavior, can you actually deduce 11-dimensional supergravity? The meta content?
No, I don't think it's that restrictive. There are certain, you know, when people study the behavior of the solutions near the singularity, they do some expansions and you get some exponents, and the exponents have to satisfy certain inequalities to get this. So I think there's a range of, there's some freedom.
Okay.
Yes, yes. It's not just 11 dimensions. Maybe I should say for all supergravities. Yeah, so you can go to lower dimensions, you can add the matter fields, the forms that you have in lower dimensions, and you do get BKL behavior. And that's significant because I said in 4 dimensions, if you add just a scalar field, you destroy the BKL behavior. But lower dimensional supergravities have scalar fields in addition to other things, these various form fields. And when you put it all together, you recover the BKL behavior. OK. But string theory is, of course, more than just general relativity in higher dimensions. And if you want to go more deeply into understanding singularities in string theory, we have to first change our definition of a singularity. After all, a singularity in general relativity was based on geodesic incompleteness. And that was based on the motion of point particles. In string theory, we should be thinking about strings. So the definition of a singularity in string theory should be something like not test particles, but test strings have well-behaved propagation for all time. And of course, we're not really interested in classical strings, but quantum strings. So we should probably add quantum test strings. Should have well-behaved propagation for all time. So let me tell you a little bit about the dynamics of strings, so we'll see what this definition really amounts to. Ah, yes. definition of non-singularity. Test strings do not have. Well-behaved propagation for all time. Thank you. OK, so what governs the motion of a string? Well, the standard picture is the following. Of course, a string being one-dimensional traces out a two-dimensional world sheet. So we're really looking at two-dimensional theories. And if we think about this world sheet of the string as a sort of a separate entity, we want to map it into space-time to tell us where it is at each time in space-time. So I can pick some local coordinates on space-time x, and I have some metric on space-time g. And on the world sheet, I'll have some other local coordinates, sigma. And I'll have, it's convenient to actually introduce a metric on the world sheet as well, something we can call q. And then there's an action, a two-dimensional field theory action, describing this map, basically telling us where we are, x as a function of sigma. There's a dimensionful constant, the string scale, which sits in front, that basically gives you the tension of the string. And then there's an integral over the world sheet. And it's all covariant, so we put in the root q. And then the metric, the action, just takes this form. And this is what's known as a sigma model. So it basically is just some two-dimensional field theory. And it has the interesting property that this is invariant under rescaling of this world sheet metric q. Classically, it's invariant under a rescaling where q goes to some arbitrary function times q, because the factors of the conformal factor drop out. If you quantize the string by doing some functional integral, in general, you destroy this symmetry. There is what's called a conformal anomaly. But if you choose your metric appropriately, you can restore the conformal symmetry. So that's where the equation of motion for the metric comes from in string theory, by the demand that you preserve this conformal invariance on the world sheet. So for some g, the symmetry holds quantum mechanically. And one has what's called a conformal field theory, a two-dimensional quantum theory, which has this conformal invariance. The condition you get for preserving this conformal invariance remarkably turns out to look like Einstein's equation. Starts off being, say, the vanishing of the Ricci tensor. But then there are a host of higher derivative corrections multiplied by powers of this length scale, this string scale. Now, here's somehow the key point. Strings sense space-time differently than point particles. Strings only sense space-time through this sigma model. And that means that two metrics which give rise to the same sigma model, which are equivalent as far as these two-dimensional quantum field theories go, are really equivalent as far as string theory goes. So this means that geometrically different spaces can be physically equivalent in string theory. In fact, the whole role of space-time is really turned around. In general relativity, we're used to talking about fields moving on some space-time. Whereas in string theory, the space-time arises as basically coupling constants in this theory for the motion of a string. So as I said, geometrically different space-times can be equivalent in string theory. As long as they give rise to the same sigma model, then they're indistinguishable. So let me give you two examples of symmetries, or examples of this. The first is something called t-duality. If you have a space-time with a symmetry, saying suppose the metric is independent of one coordinate, and let's suppose the coordinate is some periodic coordinate, so it has some, so it's independent of phi, say, then there's basically a change of variables you can do in the functional integral describing the quantum mechanics of the string, which ends up replacing the metric with a new metric in which, so this is basically a change of variables, replaces the phi phi component of the metric with 1 over phi phi, or, yeah, 1 over g phi phi. It also changes some other things, but this is the main effect. Now, of course, a change of variables in the functional integral has no physical significance. It's not supposed to be changing the quantum theory, this two-dimensional theory, but of course it has a huge effect on how we interpret the metric. And so here's one example where geometrically different spacetimes are actually equivalent. The simplest example of this is if we just take one flat direction. So suppose we take Minkowski space and say five dimensions and take one direction to be curled up in a circle of radius r. Then, so the standard Kluze-Klein picture. This claim is that this spacetime is indistinguishable from one in which the circle is radius 1 over r. Now, how could that be? Well, there's a simple explanation for it. Because on a space like this, the string has two possible types of states. There is the usual states in which the string is a little loop just sitting here in the space, and it's moving along. And this behaves very much like a point particle. In particular, you know that the momentum is quantized in units of 1 over the radius, so that as you make the radius very small, these momentum modes become very heavy. They require a lot of energy to excite the particle or the string to move around the circle. On the other hand, there are strings which actually wind around the circle. This is the new thing you can do when your fundamental object is one-dimensional and not point-like. And these clearly get lighter. They have an energy proportional to the radius because it's basically just a string under tension. So they will be very heavy when the circle is large, but when the circle gets very small, these become very light. And what happens in string theory is that when you make this change, so a circle of radius r is equivalent to a circle of radius, well, it turns out it's the string length squared over r. Dimensionally, correct? When you make this change from r to l squared over r, the role of these two states just changes. The light modes for the small circle are described by these winding modes, and for the big circle, they're described by these momentum modes, the strings that don't wind. And the spectrum of the string is invariant under it, all the interactions are invariant under it, and strings just can't tell the difference. So that's the simplest example, but as I said, it doesn't require the space to be flat. There's the symmetry of the sigma model, which says that whenever you have a metric which has a killing field, a symmetry which with periodic orbits, you have another equivalent description this way. Yes, Lee?
It by 1 over itself. I don't have a solution to Einstein equation, so I don't have a consistent string theory.
You don't have a solution to Einstein's equation, but you do have a solution to string theory.
Is that true?
You do. And the reason is that you change not only the metric, but you actually change some of the other fields of string theory. So in particular, you pick up a dilaton. And it's true that if you take Schwarzschild and change, you know, g phi phi to 1 over g phi phi and take the dilaton to be what you predict by this symmetry. I didn't write out the whole transformation, but you will see that you do get another solution of string theory, of the low energy equations of string theory. Yeah. Okay, one more example of how geometrically different spaces can be equivalent. And in this case, you'll see that even topologically different spaces can be equivalent, because this is something called mirror symmetry. So string theory, as you know, predicts 10 space-time dimensions. We only see 4, so 6 of them are curled up, possibly, into a small ball. So people like to consider spaces which look like four-dimensional Minkowski space cross some compact space. So this is flat Minkowski space. And this is some compact, some closed six-dimensional space. And the equations require that this metric be Ricci flat, say in the simplest case. So K is Ricci flat. And if you impose the condition that you want supersymmetry to be preserved, it's what's called Kähler, and this is what people call Calabi-Yau spaces, something called the Calabi-Yau space. OK, but the point is that if you look at the string, and now we're sort of thinking not about just this string that I've talked about, but a superstring in which you add fermions, which I haven't indicated there. If you consider the superstring, there's basically, you can change a sign in the action for the superstring. There's basically a U1 current in this theory, and you just change the sign of some U1 current in the sigma model has the effect of changing the interpretation from strings on M4 cross K to strings on M4 cross a different space. Of changing sort of M4 cross K to M4 cross K tilde, where K tilde is, in general, a topologically different six-dimensional space with a different six-dimensional metric. Still Ricci flat, of course, and still one of these so-called Calabi-Yau spaces, but it's quite remarkable. This sign is arbitrary from the sigma model standpoint. It's essentially a convention. But you change the sign on the sigma model, and suddenly your space-time interpretation changes from one particular form of the internal dimensions to a topologically and metrically different form of the internal dimensions. OK, so this all follows from the fact that the strings only sense the metric through this two-dimensional sigma model. And if they're equivalent, then they're equivalent. OK, how are we doing? Yeah, done with that. This is something you only see in the full supersymmetric version. That's right. Okay. So let me now describe. OK, so of course, one of the goals of quantum gravity is to remove understand space-time singularities. And it's long been hoped that quantum gravity will remove singularities. We saw in the loop quantum gravity approach that there are some recent results in those directions. So what has string theory done in terms of resolving singularities? So let me now go through a series of examples of singularities resolved by string theory. Okay. The simplest is like a conical singularity. These are technically called orbifolds, but they're just the singularities you get if you take flat space and you identify points under some rotation or something like that. Now, the metric, of course, is staying flat. So this is not a curvature singularity. It's a pretty innocuous singularity, except that according to general relativity's definition of geodesic incompleteness, this is definitely geodesically incomplete. The geodesics which hit the vertex just end. In string theory, it's been shown that this is not a problem, and that's essentially because strings are extended objects. They're big, sort of floppy things. They don't care so much about little point-like defects, such as a conical singularity. So strings can propagate perfectly fine on spacetimes like this. And so strings, just by the fact that they're extended objects. So this is OK. But you don't have to have flat metrics in order for the singularities to be removed. We can construct a simple example using this t-duality. So you take a metric on the plane. So if you just consider dr squared plus r squared d phi squared, under t-duality, this goes to a metric, which is dr squared plus 1 over r squared d phi squared, plus some extra fields. But as Lee was reminding us, there's the dilaton that is going to get turned on. But in any case, as far as the metric is concerned, it looks like that. And this now does have a singularity, at least according to general relativity, at r equal to 0. But according to string theory, this space is completely equivalent to this one, which doesn't have a singularity. So this would be another example of a curvature singularity now. So this says that some curvature singularities can be resolved. So there's another class of examples which come from thinking about these compact extra dimensions. Yeah, Robert? No, go ahead. Oh, you want the mic?
So do you have to worry about dilaton singularities in this case?
Well, if you were to try to sort of describe the string in this t-dual framework, sure, because the dilaton is blowing up at the same place that the curvature is blowing up and all of that. So there would be dilaton singularities, but we know by t-duality that this is completely equivalent to strings where the dilaton is constant and space is flat and everything is fine.
No, but if you would start with on the right-hand side, with a theory without a dilaton singularity.
Oh, then it would not be equivalent.
And then you would map it into something without a curvature singularity, but with a dilaton singularity.
If you start on the right with this metric and a constant dilaton, then it would map to a space which looked like this, but the dilaton would be singular. So in that case, you would not have resolved the singularity. Yeah, the singularity and the dilaton would still be important. OK, so let's go back to these examples where you had four-dimensional Minkowski space cross up one of these six-dimensional compact spaces. And it turns out that these spaces typically admit more than one metric which satisfies the field equations. So there are lots of Ricci flat metrics. sort of typically plot metrics on K. And it can happen that in some cases, a certain two-sphere, so you can have an S2 sitting inside K, shrink down to zero size as you change the metric. So you can imagine a space in which the internal space is actually changing a little bit. The metric on it is slowly changing. Because it's Ricci flat for each of these, the four-dimensional space is expected to stay approximately flat, not get large curvature, perhaps. So we can have a space in which the metric on the Ricci flat space changes. But it's evolving in such a way that this two-sphere can shrink down, goes to a point. Just because of the metric changing, even though it's still Ricci flat. Well, when this happens, you get a curvature singularity, because you've taken a whole sphere and shrunk it down to a point. So this is still a curvature singularity. But it's been shown that when this happens, you can go to this mirror description, this description which looks like M4 cross K tilde. In the mirror description, everything is perfectly non-singular. So on M4 cross K tilde, nothing is singular. And so you can continue past this point in terms of K tilde. And then if you go back to its mirror and see where what that means, it means that you've actually changed the topology. So this implies that you can change the topology. From the original Calabi-Yau space K into some new topologically different space, say K prime. And this is what's called a flop transition. So the idea here is that because we have this alternative description given by the mirror symmetry, this apparently singular point is non-singular. The evolution is equivalent to some non-singular evolution on K tilde. And so you just keep evolving past this point. And what it means is that this two-sphere shrinks down to a point, and then in this new space, it sort of blows up again in some topologically different way. And that was the first example. This was discovered in the early 90s. And it was the first example showing that you can change topology in string theory in a non-singular way. You probably know that in general relativity, this is forbidden. A topology change always requires singularities. In string theory, it's not forbidden. Yeah. No, no, no. In the mirror description, K tilde doesn't change topology, and the metric on K tilde never becomes singular. Okay, so it just looks perfectly normal in the mirror description. Okay, it's only when you go back to the original description do you see that the topology has changed. Yeah. Okay. Right. Right. Let's see. So first of all, it's simply true that if you want to map solutions of, say, the low-energy string equations to solutions, any symmetry will do. So it's not required that it be some topologically non-trivial circles. Right. Oh, it's certainly globally well-defined. It vanishes at the origin. The killing field is certainly globally defined on the plane. It's a rotational symmetry. It happens to be zero at the origin, but it's a perfectly smooth killing field. It doesn't cause any problems as far as this transformation. Okay. So there's a slight variant of this example, which I want to mention because it uses slightly different physics. So the variant is that you can again start with this M4 cross K. And again, you can change the metric on K in some way that you make keeping it Ricci flat so that it becomes singular. But now it becomes singular because, so again, you change the metric on K such that, say, an S3 goes to a point. So now, in this case, if you go to some mirror description, it's still singular. That doesn't help. And so it was thought for a while that these would be sort of singularities. But Andy Strominger showed that, in fact, these type of singularities are also innocuous in string theory, but for a different reason. And the different reason is we've learned that string theory is not just a theory of strings. It has other extended objects, the so-called brains. So, you can use other extended objects. Such as these brains. And in particular, there's a three-dimensional brain which you can wrap around this three-sphere. When the three-sphere is very big, these are very massive, and so they don't do much. They basically just sit there, and there's no interesting dynamics associated with them. But precisely when this description is becoming singular, when the three-sphere is shrinking down to the point, these three brains are becoming very light because they have a tension, but they're wrapped around basically a vanishing volume. And so they become very important dynamically. And what Strominger showed is that when you include the dynamics of these wrapped brains, the total description is again non-singular. So it was singular only because you had sort of not included, in some sense you had integrated out some relevant degrees of freedom. And when you put them back in, everything is again non-singular. So these are light sort of, and dynamically important. And so when included, so the evolution is again non-singular. So it's a qualitatively different way of resolving singularities in string theory. Yes? No, they're not warped in the sense that people talk about warped products today, that you have some sort of, ADS type thing. You can actually view this in a sort of an adiabatic approximation where the evolution is extremely slow as keeping the metric. This is just a simple product, and this is flat space. And for every point along this sort of evolution, there's a Ricci flat metric on K. So you can think of an approximate solution, which this is M4 cross that metric. And that metric is just slowly changing and becoming singular. Time. It could be time. And to do this all self-consistently, you would have to include the back reaction. And that's not really been done. But people assume that since you can do it very slowly, you won't have much trouble. You won't generate large curvature on M4, say. OK. Good. Let me give you a couple more examples, and then we'll move on. There are just many ways that people have found that string theory can resolve singularities. One that was discovered just this past year is, in a sense, a simpler version of the conifold, in the sense that all you use is ordinary strings and not brains. So we're up to E, I guess. So you can consider a space in which you have one direction compactified. So here we have an S1. But suppose that it sort of has a neck. It's smaller on one side than on the other. Now, I said before that there's a symmetry in which R goes to 1 over R, and small circles are the same as big circles. That's true, assuming you have the sort of standard boundary conditions for fermions, that they're periodic going around the circle. But you can change that. You can break supersymmetry. So if you require that the fermions are antiperiodic, that breaks supersymmetry, but we can still consider string theory in this background. Then it was shown a long time ago that these wound strings actually become massless when the circle reaches the string length. Wound strings are massless when the radius is of order the string length, and they actually become tachyonic for smaller radii. So there is an instability. Well, this has been known for 20 years, that you have these tachyons when the circle gets less than the string scale under this condition. But earlier this year, there was an interesting paper by Eva Silverstein and her collaborators, which sort of discussed the outcome of this instability. And what they showed is that when this tachyon turns on, when you have the string collapse a little bit smaller than the string scale, what this instability does is simply pinch off the neck. So they argued that this evolves to basically the neck pinches off. And so this space goes into a space which is actually disconnected. So this is another topology-changing transition, which in a general relativity description would require a singularity when the circle actually reached zero size. But in string theory, this seems to be totally non-singular. And again, it happens because of some object wound, in this case ordinary strings, wound around which are becoming light when this becomes small, whereas before we had the three brains. OK. Maybe, let's see. I should probably move on. Let me just say that there are another class of examples having to do with these brains themselves. If you put a lot of brains together, you can produce a metric which has singularities. But again, those singularities are not physical. They're believed to be, they can be understood in terms of dynamics happening on the brain. So maybe I don't think I'll need them. So I won't talk about the rest of the singularities. So let me move on. Yeah.
So you showed some examples in which different backgrounds are the same from the string point of view. So T-duality, mirror symmetry. Do we have a more general understanding of of backgrounds which are the same in string theory? Should we have, or there are only examples of symmetries but not a general understanding?
Well, I mean, the general statement is two conformal field theories, and there's one caveat. There's something called the central charge, a property of every conformal field theory, which is sort of related to the dimension of space-time. That has to be fixed. But two conformal field theories with the same central charge, well, if the two conformal field theories are equivalent and they have the same essential charge, then they're equivalent as solutions to string theory. I mean, that's the general statement, but if you want a sort of more specific description in terms of the properties of a metric or something, that I don't think we know. Well, you might get the impression from the examples that I've mentioned and several that I didn't mention that string theory is going to resolve all singularities. But let me now give you an example of one which where it doesn't. And this is exact gravitational plane waves. So one can, of course, talk about linearized gravitational waves, and we do that all the time. But there are a class of exact solutions to Einstein's equation in any dimension which correspond to exact nonlinear waves. And they take the general form in terms of some null coordinates, u and v, something like this. There's a metric, well, this symmetric tensor H, depending on u. They look something like this. And the only condition you need to satisfy the field equation is that H is traceless. So if HII is 0, then this whole space is Ricci flat. And its dependence on u is arbitrary. It's arbitrary dependence on u. OK, so this is a huge class of solutions with arbitrary functions. And physically, it corresponds to a plane wave in which, well, if you take H to be 0 outside of some finite range of u, then you would have a picture in which the space is flat. Before the wave comes, it's flat. After the wave comes, and there's some wave in here propagating off in this direction. And this H of u, well, it describes the polarization of the wave and the amplitude of the wave. Because it's a sort of plane wave, you can show the curvature is null. And what that means is all the scalar invariants you construct from it vanish. Turns out that all the corrections to Einstein's equation that string theory predict, all of these so-called higher derivative corrections multiplied by powers of the string length, also vanish. And so this is, in fact, an exact solution, not just to general relativity, but to string theory. So you can, in fact, show that this is a conformal field theory, strings propagating in this background. Now, because the amplitude is arbitrary, you can consider the case where the amplitude diverges. And in fact, you can approximate it by waves, you know, where the amplitude gets bigger and bigger and approach something where there's actually a singularity here because this amplitude has been chosen to blow up. To see whether string theory resolves this, you can study the motion of strings. So you take some string in this background and you study its propagation. And I did this with my student back in the early 90s. And what you find is that when the amplitude is finite, the strings have well-behaved propagation, as you would expect. But even if you start with the string in the ground state, you find that the string at late times is highly excited. Not surprisingly, these gravitational tidal forces have been pulling and stretching the string and leaving it in a very excited state. And in the amplitude, in the case when the amplitude diverges, you find that the string is infinitely excited. It's basically not in the Hilbert space anymore. So the string becomes infinitely excited for the singular singular wave. You can't hope that the singularity be modified by higher derivative corrections because it's already an exact solution. So I claim this is an example of a singularity which is not removed in string theory. Okay.
So Gary, is it important that the singularity of H is along a line or a high-dimensional object? If you'd construct a solution where H is only singular at a point, would then string propagation be regular?
You're saying that if it's not a plane wave, but if H was somehow singular at one point and not along the whole line?
So basically, in your analysis, is the fact that H is singular along a line, is that crucial?
Well, I don't know quite how to answer that, because of course we can only analyze this problem for a sort of restricted class of backgrounds which look like this. You can't sort of just make up a metric which is singular at a point, because then it doesn't solve the field equation. So you need somehow to construct a solution which has the type of singularity you want, and then study the strings propagating in the background. So, I mean, I don't know. We've seen examples of point-like singularities which are resolved, and that's not a problem. This is an example of a singularity which is not resolved. So I don't know. Other singularities may or may not be. Right. So here we have to sort of get into the question of what we mean by a singularity. So remember, I defined, we have a solution, and we want to decide if it's singular in string theory or not. So the criterion was to look at test strings. So I'm sort of restricting myself to a test string in this background and seeing if its propagation is well defined. That's what we do in general relativity by looking at GD6, sort of test particles. If I took a real string in this background, I agree. There would be some propagation and there'd be some back reaction. But that, I think, is more appropriate to the question of stability of the background. If you perturb it a little bit, you know, is it going to stay close to this or is it going to evolve to something different? I don't think it's the same. That sounds like a different question than asking whether the original given solution is singular. But let me just point out why this is a good thing, that string theory doesn't resolve all singularities. And it's sort of an obvious point, but one that Rob Myers and I made a little while ago. And it's just the following. Consider the Schwarzschild metric with negative mass. So you have m less than 0 Schwarzschild. And as you know, the Penrose diagram looks like this. There's a naked singularity here at r equal to 0. And r equals infinity is out here as usual. Now, at large distances, this metric has very weak curvature. So there's certainly an exact solution of string theory which looks like this negative mass Schwarzschild metric at large distances. Because it will look like this, and then the corrections will be higher powers of the curvature, and they'll all be small. So I claim that there's an exact string solution, so a solution which sort of looks like this at large r. As you come in, all sorts of things can happen. You can have, you know, these higher powers of the curvature modify things. There might be brains wrapping the two spheres, which become light, and all these new effects could come in. And it might be that the singularity is resolved, and this is perfectly fine non-singular solution string theory. If so, it would be a disaster, because that would be saying that you have arbitrarily negative energy solutions in string theory. Minkowski space would be unstable. The theory wouldn't have a ground state. So if this sort of singularity is removed, then they think the theory is just totally unstable and unphysical. Sort of arbitrarily negative energy solutions. Okay, so I think we want some singularities to remain. We don't really want a theory that gets rid of everything. Yeah.
I mean, does it follow that from the fact that you have a perturbative solution of large distances that there is a corresponding exact solution? Like, you know that this Einstein and Hoffman results that you can have perturbative solutions with masses moving in arbitrary way in general relativity, but still the full theory enforces that they move along geodesics.
You can certainly get, you know, constraints from higher order terms in a perturbation expansion. In a case like this, I don't see why that would come in. I mean, we have the curvature sort of gradually increasing. We have things aren't compact. I don't know. I don't.
In string theory, one is supposed to expect miracles.
Supposed to expect miracles. I don't think it'd be a miracle. I mean, this is why do we people want to get rid of singularity so badly? Well, we're going to come to that in the next topic, which is, I guess, the one you're most interested in. Okay. So finally, we come to the topic of singularities in. But before we do, we have more questions.
Sorry. So in this example, when you have negative mass Schwarzschild black holes, there is a good physical reason why you don't want it to be resolved. But in the previous example, do you have some physical reason why you don't want to resolve the singularity created by a plane gravitational wave?
No, I didn't have any prejudice about this when I started the calculation. No, I didn't hope that this was going to remain. It was just a calculation that was doable, and right. So it was an interesting test of singularities and an exact solution.
So there is no physical, obvious physical pathology.
Well, the obvious physical pathology is just the one that you come from your intuition in general relativity. When the gravitational wave is singular, there's infinite tidal forces. And so any object passing near that, you would expect to get infinitely stretched. That's the intuition, which seems to be borne out in string theory. It's not magically removed. I mean, the straightforward intuition, I would say, is the singularity is not removed. And you need one of these miracles or surprises of string theory to get rid of it, which doesn't seem to happen in this case. Lee?
Of negative mass Schwarzschild?
There is no
result, but why have you studied?
It's hard to study because of the fact that we don't know the solution in this region of small r. Okay, so I would say no, this is a result that we hope it's not resolved in string theory, and why we may not want all singulars to be resolved, but there is no calculation that I'm aware of which shows that the singularity actually remains in string theory. Okay, so let me finally come to the topic of singularities in cosmology. And, you know, this is probably, you know, the most important application of quantum gravity is to tell us more about the nature of the Big Bang. And in particular, the question of whether the Big Bang really is a true beginning of time, as we learn in general relativity, or whether there was a previous collapsing phase to the universe and the Big Bang was really a big bounce. So there have been, I'll say right out that there's still no definitive answer. This is an active area of research in string theory, but let me mention some of the ideas. So first of all, people who have argued for a bounce include the following. There is work by Veneziano. So I say this is sort of some sort of bounce. So Veneziano has for many years been talking about something he calls a pre-Big Bang scenario. In string theory. And Well, I may not be fair, and if there are people in the audience who know more about this than I do, please correct me. But it's my impression that this work is largely based on an assumption that when you go back in time and the curvatures become of order the string scale, there'll be higher order corrections to general relativity. That much we all agree on. But Veneziano assumes that the result of those higher order corrections will be some kind of bounds. So he again has a picture of, say, now, you know, the scale factor as some function of time. And, you know, we can't trust general relativity. General relativity certainly breaks down. But I think in these models, there's more or less an assumption of bounds. So there's no calculation which you can believe all the way through from this phase to this phase, which actually predicts the bounds. Okay, so that's, but that was the first sort of person, Veneziano and his collaborators, to try to discuss this in string theory. There's been a more recent discussion of this, which goes by the name of the cyclic universe, or ekphorotic universe. And this is being discussed by Neil Turok, Paul Steinhardt, I think Justin Curry is on some of the early papers. And here, the idea is that we think of these brains that we've talked about, and we think of the so-called brain world model, in which we're living on a free brain in some higher dimensional space. And their idea is that the Big Bang is nothing but a collision between these brains. Okay, so you have some I mean, it's an attractive idea once you accept the fact that brain worlds are a possible model for our universe. If we live on some brain, there could be other three brains out there, something like a parallel universe. And why should they be exactly parallel all for all time? If there's some relative motion, you expect them to collide. A collision would certainly be a very violent thing. To inhabitants of one of the brains, it would look like a singularity. And so they basically suggest that that's what the Big Bang was. The Big Bang was a collision of brains. And in the cyclic model, the picture is that the brains don't collide once and then move away, but they actually get attracted back to each other, and so they keep colliding again and again, and you get sort of basically a whole series of epochs. So you can have this picture, basically, where the brains keep colliding, moving apart, colliding, et cetera. OK, so that's an interesting possibility. They furthermore study the sort of geometry in a neighborhood of one of these collisions. And they made the observation that even though, sort of in terms of the natural metric on the brain, this is a curvature singularity, when viewed in the higher dimensions, the singularity looked rather mild. So the nature of the singularity was that there was no curvature blowing up in the higher dimensional space. This is sometimes called a Milne universe. And it's what you get if you take Minkowski space and identify points under a boost. So it's like a Lorentzian version of a conical singularity. You take, say, a time-like line in Minkowski space, and you boost it, and then you identify these points under the boost. So you get one of these cones, but this is now a cone in collapsing in time. And so the metric is just something like dr squared plus t squared d phi squared, something like that. Well, we'd said earlier that strings don't mind conical singularities. That was the first example of a singularity which was sort of seen to be innocuous in string theory. And so one can ask if the same thing is going to be true in these Lorentzian versions of the cones. So there's various work, and well, at least the proponents of these cyclic models argue that, yes, things are non-singular, even in this case, and that there's meaning to talk about not only evolving through this singularity, but evolving perturbations that you produce in some previous epoch through the singularity and into the next expanding universe. Personally, I have a lot of trouble with this idea. And the reason I have trouble accepting it is because, quite generically, whenever you have a situation like this where the volume of space, or even one direction, is shrinking down to a point, you find that any energy, any excitation about this, the energy is going to get infinitely blue-shifted when you approach the vertex. And so the fact that this is not a curvature singularity is unstable, and any perturbation produces a curvature singularity. Joe Palczynski and I, a couple years ago, just did the exercise of putting a single particle in this space. The gravitational effects of a single particle in that space are equivalent to the gravitational effects of a whole series of particles boosted relative to each other in the original space. And you can quickly show that the relative, when it's like having two particles colliding in a center of mass frame with an energy much bigger than their impact parameter, and you expect to form black holes. So it seems to me that even a single particle in this space could quickly produce large back reaction and produce singularities, curvature singularities. Now, that doesn't mean that this idea is necessarily wrong. It just means that we have to understand string theory a whole lot better before we can say with any confidence that you can actually have one of these bounces. Because the singularity, although it naively looks like it's much simpler than, say, the singularity in standard cosmological models like the Friedmann universe, in fact, once you put slight perturbations in it, I think will quickly become a generic curvature singularity. And we don't have the tools yet in string theory to analyze that. OK. So let me now turn to the other possibility that there's no bounce. This of course goes, yeah, question.
Yes, could I just add that in string gas cosmology, we also get the idea of a bounce.
You do get a bounce?
Yes, that's where we use T-duality.
Okay.
And
You use T-duality, yes.
Right. So in fact, that was the motivation of Fu Veneziano's work.
Yes, that's a good point. So let me just mention, I mean, there was maybe, I mean, this, I know that you did this this work with Botha, which clarified this a lot. I mean, there were some early ideas, which I think were just wrong, that said that, well, T-duality automatically gets rid of singularities and produces bounces, because after all, you have some Friedmann universe, you have some, you know, scale factor going to zero, and now you just, when the scale factor says that the size of these dimensions are less than the string scale, you go to a T-dual frame, and this suddenly goes to 1 over a squared, and the circles get very big, and you're done. Okay, that I claim is wrong, just because the fact that the circles are getting very big doesn't remove singularities. If they get big in finite time, you still have a singularity. In other words, the naive T-duality, T-dual of a space like a Friedmann universe with the, you know, scale factor going to zero, is one in which the scale factor diverges in finite proper time, and then you still get singular solutions. So T-duality by itself is certainly not enough. However, I think Rob is referring to work that with Bapa, in which you make an assumption that the matter is also t-duality invariant. Okay, and if your matter is t-dual, then you do have this possibility of matching on, you know, some contracting phase to some expanding phase, in which, yeah, I guess it would be meaningful to talk about a non-singular bounce in that case. Good. So I should have mentioned that. So you call that string gas cosmology, this idea of t-duality? Okay. Good. So that's a clever use of t-duality. So now, moving on to the opposing view, that time really begins at the Big Bang. I mean, this was argued for early on by Roger Penrose. So okay, so Penrose first pointed out that the initial state of the gravitational degrees of freedom has to be very, very special, or we would never see a second law of thermodynamics. After all, we're assuming the matter starts off in the early universe in thermal equilibrium, a state of maximum entropy. If the gravitational degrees of freedom were in some sense also in a maximum entropy state, we would not see any evolution. So he said the initial state was very special, and was certainly arguing for some understanding of the initial state, not that there was simply no initial state and that we had a simple bounce. Then, of course, there was work by Hartle and Hawking and Vilenkin and others to try to describe or come up with some form of some initial state that might be useful in various approximations to quantum gravity. Now, what about string theory? Well, in string theory, there's two things I'd like to mention. One is, again, very recent work by Eva Silverstein and John McGreevy, based on the same model. Okay, so they looked at this simple model of a Big Bang. It at least has the virtue of being an exact solution to string theory. It's flat, so we can be sure that it is a solution. And and what they showed is, well, they again sort of took anti-periodic boundary conditions for fermions. And let's look at the Big Bang case. So these are sort of circles sort of expanding out. With anti-periodic boundary conditions, you again find anti-periodic fermions. You again find tachyons when the circle reaches the string scale. And the idea is that this evolution, which is just what you'd get by sort of ordinary general relativity, is actually cut off at a point, a finite radius, when this circle reaches the string scale. And what takes over is the dynamics of this tachyon, this instability of the tachyon, which is something you don't see unless you have a theory of wound strings. So this picture is modified into something where down here you have something like a tachyon condensate. Well, first of all, I should say that this picture is much better behaved than this one in terms of this instability, because here, in order to argue that this singularity will always get replaced by a curvature singularity, I needed the fact that these circles were really shrinking to zero size, so that an arbitrarily small amount of energy injected in at early time gets infinitely blue shifted. Now, the circle only shrinks to a finite size, and so small initial, if you had a little bit of energy, that will get blue shifted, but only by a finite amount, so I don't necessarily expect large curvature here. But the question is, what happens when this tachyon turns on? And they showed that you could sort of analyze that, at least to some level of approximation in string theory, And they found sort of a one-parameter family of initial states. So they can't find a unique state, but they found sort of a one-parameter family of states describing sort of this initial tachyon condensate. And when you ask what comes out of the Big Bang in this picture, you can actually compute in string theory what strings are produced when this sort of tachyon is removed when the circles get bigger than the string scale. And they get essentially a thermal distribution, family of states. And you get sort of here some thermal. It's a pure state, so it's not actually a thermal state. But you get a thermal distribution of particles. Where the temperature is unfortunately the undetermined parameter. So we don't get a prediction for the temperature, but it's with some temperature T. Okay. But what's nice about this is it uses an inherently stringy effect, the fact that these wound strings are tachyon, to give another way of sort of resolving this Milne-type singularity and some way of thinking about this as some initial state. Yeah, Lee?
Then I'm studying generically, not in this very special case, but generically a space-time that has no time-like or no Killing fields. I'm very interested in your response to this. In such a space-time, to my knowledge, we don't have any examples of consistent world sheet descriptions that we know are consistent, because canceling the tachyon usually requires supersymmetry, which then implies a Hamiltonian by the supersymmetry algebra, and then implies that there would be on the background a time-like or a null Killing field.
Okay, so this is going beyond that. Okay, you're saying that these sort of in the past people have tried to avoid tachyons. They, you know, the supersymmetry removes tachyons in the ordinary, you know, spectrum of strings in flat space. Here, in some sense, they're putting in tachyons. Right, they're breaking the supersymmetry by these boundary conditions on the fermions precisely so that they'll have tachyons. And they want a tachyon because the tachyon will give them an instability which they can analyze in perturbative string theory and avoid the problems of large curvature associated with the Big Bang, which you can't analyze in perturbative string theory. So their motto is sometimes tachyons are good things because they give you instabilities which set in before you have to sort of deal with the full non-perturbative physics of the singularity, and you can analyze these much more easily.
Yeah, but the question is, so here's a very special example in which you can sort of, it's like Judah, you can sort of use the weakness to solve the problem, but in generic black hole singularities or generic cosmological singularities, we don't expect to have such nice flat backgrounds to work on, and we expect really to have to face the generic problem.
Well, I won't have time, I can tell, well, maybe I will very briefly, to get to 7, but there are ways that you can actually use these tachyon instabilities inside black holes. So maybe I will say a few words about that at the very end. Yeah.
When you model bouncing ekpyrotic models in 4 dimensions, you discover that for an appropriate choice of potentials, at least small perturbations remain small. I mean, the singularity is an attractor. Then you go to a higher dimensional description, then you have a Milne description in which even small perturbations are not stable. Right, because if you take a massless field, its amplitude grows. So I don't understand how you pass from a situation where the singularity is an attractor to an equivalent situation where the singularity is not an attractor. This was the technical question. The second one is more general. What happens if you resolve the final singularity in the same way? I mean, can you
You mean using these tachyons?
Yeah, to resolve the original Milne that you drew, the one where the singularity is in the future.
Yeah, that actually is something which is currently being looked at. I mean, you might ask, well, which of these one-parameter states do you get, or something like that. That's something which is being looked at, and in fact, work that Eva Silverstein and I are currently doing to apply all this to black holes requires that we apply it inside a future singularity. So, I mean, I can talk to you privately about what we're doing, but there's no real results there, so I won't, not yet. But let me sort of mention one more sort of result, which has been discussed recently in the connection of these no-bounce approaches. And that's work that I did last year with Thomas Hertog. And what we did was to use another sort of powerful insight we've gotten out of string theory in the past few years, which I haven't talked about yet. And this is the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence. Which says that string theory on spacetimes which asymptotically approach anti-de Sitter space, the space of constant negative curvature, is actually completely described and in a sense completely equivalent to an ordinary field theory, a conformal field theory, now not in two dimensions like we were talking about for these perturbative strings, but in higher dimensions. And in fact, this conformal field theory lives on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space in the sense that if you draw one of these Penrose diagrams for anti-de Sitter space, it looks like a cylinder, infinity being brought into a finite distance with a negative cosmological constant has a space-like, sorry, a time-like infinity here. So this was very attractive to us because the idea that everyone has, or many people have, is that when you approach a singularity, space and time themselves will lose meaning. The space and time are only an approximate concepts. And to really understand that, you should use more fundamental description in which you're not starting with anything like a background space-time. So the idea is that if you could find initial data which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, but which under evolution evolved to something like a big crunch. In other words, evolved to a singularity which was not localized inside an event horizon, but in fact went all the way out to infinity. Then you could go to the dual description in terms of the CFT and ask, what is it, how does it describe this, this space-like singularity? So we in fact found an example in the context of string theory, solving the supergravity equations for a sort of regular initial data to evolve to the singularity. And then when we went to the dual field theory, we found the following. Well, the dual field theory is quite complicated, and unfortunately it's at strong coupling, so it's hard to analyze exactly. But it looks roughly like a theory in 2+1 dimensions. We started with a four-dimensional ADS. So its boundary is three-dimensional. And, well, the field theory is approximately like a scalar field theory which has an ordinary kinetic term, a mass term, and a, plus v, where the potential has an ordinary mass term, but then a minus, say, k phi to the sixth. So this is a little strange. As field theories go, you can take a sort of various approximations. So the potential is something like this. And if you just do a semi-classical approximation, what you find is that you have some sort of perturbatively stable vacuum here. Non-perturbatively, it's unstable. In some time, you will tunnel through the barrier, end up here, And then it turns out you roll down the potential and reach infinity in finite time. This is one of those cases where the potential is steep enough that you can actually reach infinite potential in finite time. So what do you do? Well, we try to sort of go beyond a semi-classical approximation and do a more complete quantum description. First, just for the zero mode. So if you restrict to homogeneous configurations, this is a field theory living on the boundary, so it really lives on S2 cross time, it's living on some free sphere. But if you restrict to, it's basically a mini superspace approximation. Which just says you take phi to be a function only of time. This reduces to an ordinary quantum mechanics problem. It's a quantum mechanics problem for a particle in this potential, where this is now just v as a function of x. And in this case, what you find is that the Hamiltonian is not well defined without some extra input. Technically, the Hamiltonian is not essentially self-adjoint, so you have to make it into a self-adjoint operator, you have to specify some boundary conditions at infinity. So in mini superspace, you get quantum mechanics, and you need sort of extra input, which is like this boundary condition at infinity. But once you've picked your boundary condition, you have a nice Hamiltonian operator, and you can evolve for all time. So what happens is that you show that the expectation value of x, if you start with some wave packet, the expectation value of x can go to infinity in finite time, but then it comes back. Evolution continues. That looks like a bounce. So for a while, we thought this model was predicting bounces. But then we realized that this mini superspace approximation is a terrible approximation because it's missing a crucial physical effect. In a full field theory, of course, there's many degrees of freedom, not just the homogeneous mode. And when the zero mode or the homogeneous mode starts rolling down this hill, the inhomogeneous modes are unstable, and they very quickly become populated, they become excited, and this is something that the cosmologists call tachyonic preheating. As discussed here by Lev Kaufman and Dick Bond and their collaborators. So this tachyonic preheating idea discussed in cosmology would also come into play here, saying that as you roll down the potential, you excite all sorts of other modes. And now it's very unlikely that you would find something as simple as a bounce. A bounce would require all of those modes to suddenly sort of reconvert, to reverse their directions, recombine, put all their energy back into into the zero mode, and to shoot it up the hill. So this gives sort of a natural asymmetry between future singularities and past singularities. The idea is something that evolving to this big crunch corresponds to having the field basically generically roll down the hill, produce all these inhomogeneous modes, and you have something more like some very chaotic thermal state. In fact, it's an interesting question whether there's any connection between this tachyonic preheating and the BKL behavior that I mentioned at the very beginning of this talk. But we don't expect anything like that to describe the initial singularity. The initial singularity seems to be something more like a very special initial fluctuation or something which would cause the zero mode to run up the hill. Anyway, this is still not the final story because, as I said, the CFT is very hard to analyze exactly, and this is more or less sort of a crude approximation to what that might be talking about. But I'm out of time, so I think I should quit there. Thank you.
I don't know if this qualifies as an urgent question, but there's something I don't understand about this McGreevy-Silverstein scenario that you mentioned. Uh-huh. This temperature is computed in the asymptotic future, I presume, when the space gets very large?
No. No. It is actually computed, you know, they do an approximation where the circle is expanding slowly. And then their string, they model this, sort of some neighborhood of this, by essentially a circle which is not changing in time, but which has some fixed radius, which is you know, slightly tachyonic, something like that. And then they can compute the particles created, and they get some thermal spectrum here, which is supposed to represent the thermal, sort of the initial thermal spectrum. If they waited till late time, then it would, of course, be zero, because everything gets redshifted away. So their temperature is more or less, it's supposed to be sort of the initial temperature of the particles soon after space becomes meaningful.